Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim. Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. Our goal is to help you become a better leader. This week, we're happy to have join us Magnus Nicolin. Magnus is the CEO of Ansel, a global company that has over 13,000 employees. He has had a career of working globally throughout his career, and he has some great insights around leadership and how to build a healthy culture within your organization. We're looking forward to today's conversation with Magnus. First off, Magnus, could you give us just a little bit of a overview of your career and a little bit of your story?
Thank you, Mark, and it's a pleasure to be with you. Yes, I've had a very global career. First of all, I'm Swedish to start with, but pretty much the day after I got married and just after I had finished my undergrad, I moved from Sweden and pretty much lived around the world ever since. It started out in Paris, where I initially joined the big French bank, one of the biggest banks in the world at the time. And it turned out to be a stroke of luck in some ways, because I was given sort of way more responsibility than I should have been given, given that I was new. And so I got to do syndicated credits and euro bond issues and so forth. And the fact that I was given all these responsibilities, I was fluent in English, and many of my French colleagues in Paris at the time were not so fluent. So whenever it got really complicated and needed to talk to the big American banks or something, they asked me, okay, Magnus, why don't you take care of it? There's no better way to grow and learn than to be thrown in the deep end of the pool, right? So that's what happened, and that was sort of a great experience. And that's eventually led me to come to the U.S. Go to business school in Philadelphia, Wharton, which turned out to be not so much an educational opportunity or challenge or need, but more an entry ticket into the United States. And I think a lot of us understand that you sort of need to get some stamp of approval in some form. And that's what it was, but it was also just a great experience in getting to understand and know the U.S., the culture and the way of conducting business and being successful and so forth. And it's sort of been cemented firmly into my brain ever since that the United States is a really unique country and a unique culture focused on can do. And it's so refreshing, and especially being back in Europe more these days, I sort of miss that. Nothing is impossible. You make your own destiny, kind of thing. And I love that about the country. And for that reason, I stayed in the U.S. for 27 years or something like that. So that's where the bulk of my career has been. And it started out in consulting, and then and consulting McKinsey and Mercer was a lot of fun and a great way to learn. But fundamentally, it didn't sort of satisfy my need to do and drive and act. And that essentially led to, at some point, I left McKinsey and joined one of my clients, de facto, in a turnaround mission in Canada. So I was sent up to Canada for 3 years to fix the business there. Did that and then came back to the U.S. and eventually joined Pitney Bowes, a very American company at the time. And the mission was really to help the company reshape itself from a postage company. And we can all understand after the fact that was probably kind of an important mission to get away from snail mail to focus on messaging, which is exactly what we did at that time. Eventually got into and was hired into a global company in office products. And that was quite an interesting journey and story in and of itself. Also a business that wasn't exactly growing fast, except there were some parts of the business that were, and that's what we tend to focus on, label making, for example. So getting people organized in one, and that was very, very successful. But eventually I ended up leaving. I had a bit of a disagreement with the then CEO. I was sort of number two in the company, and he wanted to go in one direction. I wanted to go in another. And I essentially said to him, if we can't agree, you should fire me. And the week after he fired me, and I said, thank you. But it really is for me a lesson in, you got to stand up for what you believe in. And if you don't believe in the direction your company is going, and you are a leader and you're supposed to sell that vision to the team, you can't do it if you don't believe in it. So take your brain elsewhere is sort of my advice to any leader. You have to really do what you believe in. And that's what I did. I got involved in private equity and eventually bought out my former company and then became the CEO of the company. So I think doing what you believe in can pay dividends too. It was a great experience being involved in private equity and driving that business. And eventually we sold the fastest growing division for, 50% more than the total value of the company. After that, I left. Since then, I worked with Anil Rubmaid in a global position based partly in Europe and being responsible for Europe and Asia. Classical turnaround, a bit of a messy situation. I got that business fixed, and then I was hired by Ansell, and I've been at Ansell now for 11 years. And it's been sort of a very interesting area of safety. And I think we've all gotten to know the term PPE. In the last little while, and that's the sweet spot of what Ansell does, where safety, gloves and suits and those kinds of things for industrial and medical customers. So a very interesting company with a strong position, super global. So in some ways, a good fit for me. So long answer to a short question.
Sure. Well, tell us a little bit about the size of the company and your responsibility. You are very global, and we were just talking before we got started that you've kind of had a front seat to all that's been happening the last year and a half. But talk a little bit about your company and kind of your scope.
So Ansell is about a $2 billion revenue company. We are formally based in Australia. Well, we're listed in Australia on the Australia Stock Exchange, but we're a global company. Head offices by design are in New Jersey, in Brussels, Belgium, in Kuala Lumpur, and in Melbourne. So we have four head offices. And we did that by design because we don't want to be viewed as an American company or a European company or an Australian company. We're global. So we're not anchored anywhere. And everywhere at the same time. My leadership team, I have eight nationalities on it. So it's a very multicultural, extremely diverse team. And I think that's the power of what we are able to do as a global company. So we are number one in the world when it comes to hand protection. So we produce gloves for industrial, automotive, and so forth, typically knitted and dipped. And we produce single-use gloves, also for industrial, but healthcare. And then we do surgical and life science for those categories. So it's a broad range of products, the widest in the industry. We are the biggest player in the industry. We typically have a number one and number two position in every market, every product, and every segment. And that's been by design. And every segment that we were in or any products that we were in, that we judged we couldn't be number one and number two, we sold. And then we doubled down on the others. So we've done that consistently now, and it's worked well. We've delivered a 4x increase in share price over the time. But more importantly, we delivered a capability where we have strength in innovation that goes really, really far. We're now starting to help customers anticipate injury. So, for example, we can put a little device on the back of your hand and we can monitor your hand movements. And if you do too many of these twists and turns in your daily job at an automotive plant, for example, we can predict that you will get MSD or musculoskeletal disease 10 years from now.
Wow.
So stop doing that. So we can put a little buzzer on the hand that says, don't do that. And it will remind you, almost like a Fitbit device, that stop doing that. And we can demonstrate significant improvement in behavior, and therefore that you will not get MSDs in the future. This is tremendously powerful because you essentially avoid a $100,000 cost item for the company to take care of the employee who ends up with some ergonomic injury and so forth. This illustrates what you can do when you own a platform like the glove, and you can put intelligence on that platform and essentially help the company, the safety officer, but also the employee to actually avoid that and be safe. So we're a safety company, we're not a glove company, and that's what we preach all the time. We help customers take care of their employees, keep them safe and productive. Keeping somebody safe is easy. Keeping them safe and productive at the same time is really, really hard. So that's where our sweet spot is.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, using technology to, you know, you'd think a glove, there's not not a lot of, you know, technology with that, but you're putting some additional things that they're definitely making a difference. Talk a little bit. One of my favorite questions to ask leaders as they come on the podcast is if you were able to spin back time, thinking back to when you were 22, what advice would you give yourself if you were able to go back, knowing what you know now, to a 22-year-old Magnus?
It probably would be more along the lines of think longer term, plan your pathway a little bit. I think when I look back, it was probably a little bit too much hand to mouth. Do this, and then that yielded this opportunity, and created sort of the next step. I think if I'd been a little bit more measured about do this for 2 years and then do that kind of thing, probably would have been a little bit more efficient, maybe a little bit smarter. But I think ahead. It's a bit like a chess game. You can't just think about the next move. You have to think 10 moves ahead. And that would be my advice. And who knows if I would have followed that advice. But it certainly is something you can conclude after a career in business, in living and working in multiple countries, try and anticipate.
You've hired a lot of people over your career and had responsibility. You have what, over 13,000 employees as far as in your company. So thinking about, you know, and again, we have a number of first-time leaders, first-time CEOs that listen to the podcast. Yeah. What advice would you give them around people on hiring and putting together teams? What are some things that you've learned?
Yeah, I mean, some of it is quite classical, not very surprising. Hire the best people. Dare to hire people who are better than you are, because you will grow. You will cause yourself to run a little bit faster, and that's healthy for everybody. The other one is style. You can hire the best athlete, the best individual contributor, but they need to fit in to the company, to the culture, to the style you want to have. I think my biggest mistakes probably have been hiring a really smart person who then was difficult to work with or had a certain style about him or her that simply didn't fit. And then you create so much turbulence that even if the individual is amazing, the team loses in effectiveness. The leadership team loses in effectiveness. So a style assessment, really trying to understand how will this person fit in? What are the strong points stylistically and that you can leverage, and what are the potential pitfalls or watchouts that you're going to have to manage or decide not to hire because they're probably going to be too great. So style is a key one. And then finally, empower. If you do hire these amazing individuals, then they need room, space. So you can't babysit them. You need to give them room to be their self. And that's what I've done in my whole career. I leave a lot of room for people to be strong, be hard driving, and then focus more on managing how it all comes together. You still need to put a shrink wrap on the whole management team and the plan and on the strategy. It needs to hang together. But within that, the individuals must be allowed to drive.
So you've got so many cultures that are represented in your company, you know, as far as geography and language and that. How do you keep a culture of an organization as large as yours is, and how do you keep that healthy? Talk a little bit about that.
Well, we have from the first day with the company, we do an annual engagement survey. So we go out to, initially we did it with the professional staff, and then we launched it to all staff, all 13,000, where we essentially interview them. There's like 30 questions. We asked them about how we get things done and what do you like about the company, generally speaking. What about communication? What about training? So there's a lot of questions about how we work and what advice would you have? So it's a lot of check marks, and they're done in a couple of different ways so that you validate that you get the true opinion. And then there's some pre-for-all fill in your own commentary and whatnot. And then we act on that. So we sum it all up for the company, and we get some themes, and it might be, oh, we should do better communication or more training, or we need to be more transparent, or something of that nature. And then we work on that and we communicate that. This is what you told us. This is what we're going to be working on. And then a year later, we do the survey again. So we've seen a steady improvement in engagement. Now, this was done on top of an organization that was actually quite passionate as it was. It was striking to me when I joined Ansell that there was a lot of fire in the belly in the company. People were very intrigued and interested in what the company is all about. And you can understand when you think about our mission, we're safety, right? So we're selling something that's really good for mankind. We always joke around saying that we're not selling brown sugary water. We're selling safety. We protect people from getting injured. And that loops back to a point where people are saying, hey, I really feel good about being part of this company because I'm helping the world. And so that passion was there. And if you harness that passion and listen carefully to their advice on how we can improve engagement further and so forth, I think you have a recipe to really bring the team together. And it doesn't matter whether you're sitting in Malaysia or in Sri Lanka or in Portugal or in Canada, it sort of comes together with the same noble mission, if you will, that we are protecting workers, healthcare workers, from getting injured or getting infected. And that's a good mission to have. And we do it in a way where management constantly shares with us what's going on in the company, regular updates, mission is laid out, here's your role, here's how it fits in. And by playing it that way, I think we are reinforcing that passion and we're seeing it grow, and engagement is now getting to world-class levels. So.
We talked previously that you do some things as far as to just keep your hand on the pulse of the company. There are times where you've gone out and you've met with a lot of team members and people that typically maybe a CEO wouldn't be meeting with, sure. just to talk a little bit about your philosophy around that and kind of how you implement that in kind of a day-to-day.
I sort of got started on this early in my career. It was sort of my first line job when I was running a Bayer in Canada. We sort of laid out a plan, the turnaround plan, if you will, and pulled in almost every professional staffer in Canada into a different task force. So we had 14 task forces going, and the value of that was as we developed the plan and the action steps that we were going to change to win again, the plan was owned by every employee in the company. They all had a stake in the plan. So that made me sort of see the value in really reaching deep into the company and understanding, you know, the frontline salesperson or the warehouse worker or the customer service representative. And so based on that, and ever since, I'm sort of in the teams I'm responsible for, reached deep into the team and done one-on-ones. At Ansell, I have about 250 people that I talk to on a regular basis, one-on-one, sit down, either face-to-face or these days, obviously, very often video. Ask them sort of the same questions or similar questions. How are you doing? How's your team doing? What is your mission now for the next 6 months? What's holding you back? Anything I can do to remove obstacles and that kind of stuff? Any advice for me? I mean, if you were the CEO, what would you do differently than what we're doing right now? And I sort of take note of all of these things, and they eventually emerge as themes. Okay, we probably need to change our stance on this one. The communication on what we're doing here was not good enough, because I've now got 11 proof points to illustrate that it wasn't understood. So let's fix that. And of course, it's delivering some value, if you will, to them as well, because they're essentially saying, hey, the CEO thinks that I'm so critical that he wants to talk to me and get my advice. That's a good thing. People need to feel that their voice matters and matters greatly. That's what I've been doing. And what is really good is my leadership team is doing it now as well. That's a force projection like you can't believe. I took to 250. Together, we talked to 2,500 or something like that, right? And that's essentially the entire professional workforce of Ansell that we talk to, on a regular basis. There are no secrets. We know what they like. We know what they don't like. We know what we're missing and what we need to course correct on. So
there's been a lot of lessons that CEOs and other leaders have learned in the last year that they maybe haven't learned previous. And talk a little bit about that. You've got definitely, I refer to as kind of a front row seat to the world and what's happened in a lot of different places. But what are some things that you've learned in the last year?
Well, first of all, we're a safety company. So we need to demonstrate that we practice what we preach. And it started for us early. I mean, I had my first COVID crisis meeting last week of January in 2020. That's when it just started to hit in Wuhan. And we were affected immediately in our Chinese plant, and we had to shut down our Shanghai sales office shortly thereafter. So we codified some lessons learned very quickly from that early experience. In a couple of weeks, we had our plan of attack ready, and then we started to roll it out to all of our plants and offices around the world, even before COVID was viewed as a big issue. And so that helped us. We also decided early on that we are going to side on caution here. We are involved in safety, so let's make sure that we demonstrate that. So we sent our people home from offices around the world way before most other companies did, and essentially kept it that way. Luckily, we had invested in a video conference platform, Teams, Microsoft Teams, about 6 months before, and had started to use it quite effectively. And so it was quite seamless going into a home working mode. And the team has been very, very effective and very pleased with how they're performing and all that kind of stuff. So we decided to change our policy to the point where we're never going to go back to the way we were. We're going to go to probably working in the office 2 or 3 days a week and then working from home the rest of the time for everybody. On top of that, we are learning as well that you don't need to do the crazy amount of travel that we used to do, all of us. You can travel a little bit less, and maybe you should travel less but longer to really get into the weeds a little bit more. When you do show up in Malaysia or in Thailand, don't just zoom in and do a plant tour and zoom out again. Well, go in there and spend some time with the team. And you really learn what's going on. And I think that's another lesson learned here, that you can see a silver lining from this terrible pandemic, and we can actually become better as a result of it.
So every leader that I talk to is wanting to continue to grow in their knowledge. And are there any books that you recommend to leaders and on your team or others that as you talk to them?
I'm not a big reader of books on sort of professional developments and so forth. I'd rather focus in on understanding the world. So it's more news and how the world is evolving and forming opinions as to what's going to happen next. I have myself, there are a couple of books written about sort of the first 100 days. And I find that quite interesting because I think we're all, certainly when we move jobs or come into a new role, we do have that unique window where we're not biased by convention, where we can think freely. But that window closes rather fast. So you better move with a lot of determination and use your independence of the first 100 days to do a lot of the heavy lifting and norming and storming and that kind of stuff. So I do like a couple of those books because they give you a little bit of a way to orchestrate your agenda. What am I going to do in the first 10 days and the second 10 days and the third 10 days and that kind of stuff. On my side, whenever I've moved jobs, it's been all about that. The first month is all listening. Travel and do get to meet people and listen with an open mind, because your mind is not going to stay open very long. So that first week, and I remember from my McKinsey days, it sounds kind of funny, but very often you form an opinion as to what the right answer is. Not in the first month of heavy analytical work, but in the first three interviews. And it's kind of risky because they may not be representative, but the early impression is so powerful. So you better marshal your early impressions really, really well.
So outside of work, what do you do to recharge? I know you live in Brussels for part of the year and then traveling, but what are some things that you do to recharge?
Well, I play tennis, and I do some kayaking, I do some biking. So it's mostly about getting out and about and move. I love gardening. It's sort of part of seeing things grow, right? Yeah. Much like businesses, seeing things grow.
Sure.
And shape it to look like you want it to look. So it's that. I travel enough for business, so that doesn't hold a huge attraction for me when it comes to free time. But obviously spending time with my wife and being outside is probably the best way to sum it up. And that brings so much energy back into what we need to do in our daily grind, right?
Yeah, absolutely. What parting advice would you give a new or up and coming leader?
It's all about you need to love something about every situation. It's sort of a life lesson for me is in the early days in the Marines, in basic training, we're crawling through a muddy field, and it was raining and it was disgusting. And the drill sergeant was screaming over our heads, "Gilla läget," which that mean in Swedish translates into English, "love the situation," right? And of course we didn't. But I took it with me anyway, and I think he's right. Every terrible or difficult or nasty situation, there's something you can take away from it. So I think that's probably the most important life lesson for me. Find something you like about every circumstance and then turn it into an advantage. And then you just need to be persistent about it. And determined and keep pushing and so forth. But like the situation.
Yeah. Well, that's some great advice. And I know this conversation is going to be helpful to those that listen to it, and wish you continued success at Ansel and all that you're doing. And we'll look forward to seeing how the next year shapes up. But I know that everybody's learned some lessons that are valuable, and the things you shared today were definitely that.
Thank you, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.